There is a quite famous story about a young man named Derek Redmond. He was born back in the late 1960s. His parents had immigrated to England before he was born. And as he grew up in the 70s and 80s, Derek loved running. And he was encouraged in that by his father. Would take him around, get him some trainers. Derek ended up winning the British Championship for the 400 meter four times, setting the British record in the meantime. He qualified for the 1988 Olympics. This was the pinnacle. He was super excited for the 400 meter run, and he gets down there on the track. He's waiting for the other runners to go, and as he's warming up for his race, he blows his Achilles right before, not 10 minutes before his race, and has to withdraw. Heartbroken. Over the next few years, Derek has five surgeries to try to get ready for the 1992 Olympics. And he just makes it. He qualifies. He makes it to the 1992 Olympics for England, running the 400 meter. He runs the opening heat, does good. He gets to the quarterfinals and actually runs the fastest time in the quarterfinal. And he's lining up for the semis, and he's ready. He's geared up. His body feels really good after all those surgeries. And he starts running that 400 meter. And just shy of the halfway mark of that race, he hears a pop. And his hamstring completely snapped in half. You guys should go and watch the video. And he immediately hobbles up, slows down, and drops to the track. He looks around and watches the other runners finish the race. And he makes a decision in the moment that he's not just going to withdraw from this race. So he stands up with a split in half hamstring, and he starts shuffling and hopping and hobbling as best he can to try to finish this race. Because in his mind, he's going to make it around. But he also knows his body from previous injuries that this is going to be the last time he does this. And he's not going to just leave the track. And he's having a real hard time getting around the track. And as he's going and he rounds that last curve, you can see a guy in the background. There's a kind of, I don't know, kerfuffle. And this guy leaves the stands, breaks past the security, and he comes up next to Derek and puts his arm around him, and it's Derek's father, Jim. And Derek begins to cry into his father's shoulder as his father helps him around the track. And you can see other security guys, Olympic officials come up, and as his father is comforting Derek, he is shooing those guys away. And he's saying, "My son's finishing this race. Get away from me." And they make it all the way around. They make it past the finish line and off the track. And the crowd there that day, it was 65,000 people. They didn't understand what was happening. They just thought, this was, one of the last races of the day. But when they realized this was his father, they all stood to their feet and they started cheering him on as they're coming around. You see, when someone like Derek is properly motivated and properly helped along, nothing can stop them as they keep going and keep going in what they're doing. And that's what we're going to see today. The Apostle Paul talks about this very thing in Romans chapter 10. Romans chapter 10. So turn in your Bibles to Romans 10. If you're using a Bible in the pew rack, it's on page 946. 946. And if you need a Bible, please take that one home. Everybody needs a Bible they can understand. We've got others in the office. Large print, small print, youth Bibles, kids Bibles, Bibles with study notes, Spanish Bibles. We'd love to hand you one for free before you walk out of here. Just see me or Jared and we'll make sure you get one. But here in Romans 10, Paul had just finished talking in Romans 9 about how God gave the Old Testament prophecies, particularly to the Jews, so they could apply those prophecies to their lives and they could tell other people. But instead of doing that, applying the prophecies and telling other people, the Jews started thinking that they were special simply because they had the prophecies. And Paul says, that's not what it's about. He says, having the prophecies, that doesn't save you. What saves you is having faith in God's gracious gift of Jesus' death and resurrection. That's the only thing that saves you. That's how he finished Romans chapter 9. And then he begins in Romans 10. Look at verse 1. This is what he says. He says, "Brothers, my heart's desire and prayer to God for them is that they may be saved." So even though in Romans 9, Paul had said, there's going to be a whole bunch of Jews, even though they have the prophecy, they're not going to believe in Jesus. It was prophesied in the Old Testament that they wouldn't. He said, but still, he says, my prayer, my heart's desire is that they would believe, just as it is for everybody. He wants everybody to believe. Paul is constantly sharing the gospel. And he wants these people especially. Look at verse 2. He says, "For I bear them witness that they have a zeal for God, but not according to knowledge." So they were zealous religiously, but he says zealous for the wrong thing. They thought they could earn God's favor. And Paul said, that's not what it's how to do that. Belief, faith, is the only way for God's favor. The only way to heaven is by having faith. Look at verse 3. "For being ignorant of the righteousness of God," that's God's salvation, "and seeking to establish their own righteousness, their own way of salvation, they did not submit to God's righteousness. For Christ is the end of the law for righteousness to everyone who believes." So they did not apply God's prophecies. They did not apply God's plan of salvation. They tried to earn their own salvation. They tried to make their own way to heaven by earning their salvation instead of following God's way to heaven. And he says, really, Jesus is the end goal of the law. The whole law, the whole Old Testament points to Jesus, anticipating Jesus coming. And there's a whole bunch of people who refuse to believe that. Not just then, today, there's people who refuse to believe in Jesus, a whole bunch of them. Verse 5, Paul says, "For Moses writes about the righteousness that is based on the law, that the person who does the commandments shall live by them." He says, okay, you want to earn your way to heaven. If you want to live by the law, you better not miss even one of them. But of course, every one of us sins. We miss the law. Because the reality is, as Paul has said in previous chapters, the law was never supposed to save you. The law was never meant to save anybody. All the law was supposed to do was to show you you're a sinner and you need Jesus to save you. And so Paul says these people have the wrong idea. Verse 6, "But the righteousness, the salvation based on faith says, do not say in your heart, who will ascend into heaven? That is, to bring Christ down, or who will descend into the abyss." That's their belief of where the dead people were. "That is, to bring Christ up from the dead." Now, you may read that and say, okay, this is kind of weird, and I don't understand what Paul's talking about. He's saying this is salvation that's based on faith, so the true way of salvation that he started talking about back in chapter 9. Salvation by faith doesn't require any efforts on our part, even exceptional efforts, such as bringing Jesus to earth to begin with. God's already done that. Or raising Jesus from the dead. God's already done that. We can't do it. That's the only way to salvation is by believing in Jesus coming, living, dying, and raising. Paul says, you can't do it. Only God can do it. Salvation requires God's efforts and not our efforts. He did all of the work for us. We just have to believe. Verse 8, "But what does it say?" The salvation that comes by faith. He says, "The word is near you. It's in your mouth and in your heart." That is the word of faith that we proclaim. "Because if you confess with your mouth that Jesus is Lord and believe in your heart that God raised him from the dead, you will be saved." So this is what salvation by faith does say. It's readily available through believing in your heart, through confessing with your mouth. You don't have to do anything. You just have to believe. It's already been done for you. It's right next to you. It's right near you. Simply believe. It's not a long, drawn-out, complicated process. It's very simple. God made it simple because we need it simple. Verse 10, "For with the heart, one believes and is justified, and with the mouth one confesses and is saved." Now, we're justified, that means to be made right before God. Paul uses that throughout Romans to simply mean being saved. So he has here in verse 10, two parallel phrases that mean the same thing. You believe in your heart, you're saved. You confess with your mouth, you're saved. You're acknowledging both with your belief and with your words that Jesus is the Lord. He is the Son of God, coming, dying for your sins, raising so you can live after you die. He says that's what salvation is. Look at verse 11. For the scripture says, everyone who believes in him will not be put to shame. Now, Paul quoted this verse at the end of the previous chapter, verse 33 of the previous chapter. So he's already quoted this verse, and now he's just quoting a little section of it. Everyone who believes in him will not be put to shame. There's no disappointment in believing the gospel. You believe the gospel, you confess with your mouth, believe in your heart, you will be saved. There's no disappointment because heaven is what we receive. Heaven is what is guaranteed. Now notice, this is something Paul's going to build on, that word in that verse. He says everyone. It's not limited to one person or another person. It is available for everybody. Verse 12. For there is no distinction between Jew and Greek. For the same Lord is Lord of all, bestowing his riches on all who call on him. For everyone who calls on the name of the Lord will be saved. Now he introduces this idea that he's already been talking about now for several chapters. That everyone, there's no distinction between Jew and Greek, which the Jews had always believed there is. They've got a special place. They got first in line to heaven simply because they're Jews. And Paul's now been talking since chapter 8 that that's not the case. The only way to heaven is by having faith in Jesus. Not because of where you came from, not because of who your parents were or your lineage is. It's simply by believing in Jesus. He says there's no distinction between Jew and Greek. There's no cutting the line. There's no favoritism. We're the same. Same Lord is Lord of the Jews, Lord of the Gentiles. You just have to believe in Jesus, on all who call in the name of the Lord. That verse 13, Paul says this a couple of different times in Romans. It's also in the book of Acts. It's a quote from the prophet Joel. And the Jews reading this would have known that. Everyone who calls on the name of the Lord will be saved. But to them, they had been taught that verse, meaning it's just for Jews. Everyone who is a Jew who calls on the name of the Lord. And Paul, by quoting this verse from the prophet Joel, is saying, you guys, if you go back and actually read it, it's not everyone who's a Jew who will be saved. It's everyone in the world who calls on the name of the Lord will be saved. Even people who have done horrendous things, if they come to Jesus, Jesus can save them. No matter how horrendous the thing, Jesus' death is enough to cover it. Everyone who calls on the name of the Lord will be saved. Like he just said, there's no distinction. Anybody, everybody can come to salvation. Verse 14. How then will they call on him in whom they have not believed? And how are they to believe in him of whom they have never heard? And how are they to hear without someone preaching? And how are they to preach unless they are sent? As it is written, how beautiful are the feet of those who preach the good news. Now, when Paul's talking about preaching, he's in the way he's using it, he's not talking like what I'm doing right now, standing on a platform, a bunch of people sitting in pews, because you're like, okay, he's talking preaching that doesn't apply to me. When Paul talks about preaching like this, he's simply talking about having a conversation with somebody about the gospel. That's what preaching is to Paul. Having a conversation with somebody, it could be like this, to a group of people about the gospel, or it could be one-on-one, having a conversation about the gospel. So Paul says, God sends messengers with the gospel, which he did. Go and make disciples of all nations, Matthew 28, Acts 1, you will be my witnesses, testifying about me to the ends of the earth. So we have the responsibility to tell people about Jesus. We saw it last week. Jesus said in Luke 19:10, the Son of Man came to seek and to save the lost. And then John 21:20, and as he came, he is giving us his responsibility to seek and save the lost. So it's our responsibility to tell people about him. So God sends out messengers. You know, actually, when Jesus sent out his 12 apostles, that word apostle in the original language means somebody who's been sent out with a message. Somebody sent out with a message, which they all were, which we all are. We've been sent out as God's messengers. And so here in verses 14 and 15, God sends messengers. The messengers speak the gospel. The messengers speak Jesus. He says there, and then once it's spoken, it's heard. The gospel is heard. Jesus is heard. And once it's heard, those hearers can believe in the gospel, can believe in Jesus. And those believers then can call on the name of the Lord and be saved. He said, this is the process. God did send us. We've got the message. He did send us. But it's on us to tell. And once we tell, it's on him to do the saving. It's not our job to save people, but it is our job to tell people. We're not supposed to simply reveal to people the gospel through osmosis. Just I'm close to you. Maybe the gospel will rub off on you just by my aura being around you down the macaroni aisle at Walmart. He says, no, you got to communicate it verbally. That's that word preach. You got to communicate it verbally. You know, there's that famous internet quote. I've referenced it before. And as with all internet quotes, you know where those come from. It's attributed on the internet to St. Francis of Assisi that preach the gospel and if necessary, use words. St. Francis actually said the exact opposite of that. He said, tell people with your words about Jesus. That quote comes from somebody not wanting to communicate about Jesus. That's where that quote comes from. It's not a legit quote from anybody who is following Scripture. He says, tell people about the gospel. You've been given it. It's yours to give. You go and give. They'll hear it. Once they hear it, they can believe and be saved and call on the name of the Lord. So we need to speak Jesus. Verse 16. Well, that first of all, there in verse 15, that I think that's an Isaiah verse. How beautiful on the mountains are the feet of those who preach the good news. That it is in God's sight a beautiful thing for anybody to share the gospel with anybody else. How beautiful are the feet of those who preach the good news. And you can imagine, just try to imagine the feet from back then. Sandals, walking everywhere, dirt everywhere. They didn't bathe, you know, very often at all. How beautiful those feet would be, not because they are visually appealing, but because of what they're doing, bringing the gospel to everybody. And that was from the Old Testament. That was from God giving the prophecies and the message to the people to apply it and to take it, just as he does now. He's given us the word to apply it to our lives and to take it to people who need it. So now look at verse 16. But they have not all obeyed the gospel. For Isaiah says, Lord, who has believed what he has heard from us? So faith comes from hearing, and hearing from the word of Christ. Hearing comes from the word of Christ. That's an important thing. Faith comes from hearing, and they hear through the word of Christ. You see, speaking about Jesus is allowing Jesus to speak and work through you. Says there in that verse, it's the word of Christ. It's his words in you. So you're allowing him to work through you, allowing him to speak through you when you speak his words. But then Paul asks the inevitable question, will anybody really hear from you when you speak? That was in Jeremiah chapter 1, when God came to Jeremiah and said, I want you to preach. And Jeremiah said, God, I'm way too young to be doing any of that. And besides that fact, nobody's going to listen to me. I mean, God ended up telling Jeremiah, it doesn't matter if they listen to you or not. You're supposed to go out there and do it. Just say what I tell you to say. Go where I tell you to go, and I'll take care of the rest. And so here, that's the question Paul's asking as we lead into the next verse. Will anybody ever really hear when we speak? Verse 18. But I ask you, have they not heard? Indeed they have. For their voice has gone out to all the earth, and their words to the ends of the world. So Paul's quoting, he's going to quote several Old Testament prophecies here to back up his point, just saying this isn't just a New Testament idea that comes after Jesus came and lived and died and rose. He says this was the concept, God's plan for all time to begin with. He says some people may question if everyone has the opportunity to hear. He says, well, the voice has gone out, the words to the ends of the earth. And actually this is a quote from a psalm that begins with the heavens declare the glory of the Lord. That God's message that he is real is all over the place. Paul actually talks about that back in Romans chapter 1. He says, nobody is without excuse. People may distract themselves and lie to themselves, he says, but nobody's without excuse. The heavens declare the glory of the Lord. It is everywhere. And so he says, okay, if they have heard, Paul asked the question, maybe they didn't understand. That's why they didn't believe. They may have heard the word, but maybe they just didn't get it. Look at the next verse, 19. But I ask, did Israel, the Jews, not understand? First Moses says, I will make you jealous of those who are not a nation. With a foolish nation, I will make you angry. So what Paul says here is they did understand, and they still chose not to believe. He says, I tell you, they heard it, they understood, they still chose not to believe. Even as unbelieving Gentiles were getting saved around them, they're choosing not to believe. They're choosing to walk their own path. And again, this isn't just a first century thing that's happening. There's people today you can share the gospel with and will still choose to do their own thing, walk their own way, believe their own ideas for a wide variety of reasons. So Paul's saying that's what's going on here. Verse 20. Then Isaiah is so bold as to say, I have been found by those who did not seek me. I have shown myself to those who did not ask for me. So again, Paul, who already said there were Jews who aren't going to believe. He said Gentiles came and they did believe. And now he quotes from the Old Testament saying, again, this is not a New Testament idea. This has been around forever. There's those who did not receive the Old Testament prophecies, and even they have chosen faith. They have found salvation. Not because, he says, the Jews went out and did what they were supposed to do with the Old Testament prophecies, apply it and then tell people about it. These people found their way to the Lord and salvation, not by the people who were supposed to tell them, but because they were out there seeking on their own. He says they weren't given all this stuff to show them the way, and yet they still found their way to Jesus. They still found their way to what was intended to be. Verse 21. But of Israel, you say, so it would seem as though Paul's being extremely harsh on the Jews up till now. Chapters 8 through here 10, and it's going to go on into chapter 11 too. But he's been talking about saying a bunch of them aren't going to believe. He says, I still want them to believe. I'm praying they believe. But look at what God is doing in verse 21. But of Israel, he says, all day long I have held out my hands to a disobedient and contrary people. So Paul is saying that some absolutely understood as God testifies and they still chose not to believe. But even in this verse, even in their deliberate unbelief, what's God's position there, verse 21? God is reaching out to welcome them. He's reaching out to welcome any unbelievers. Even those who have known the truth for generations and still chose not to believe. It says God is reaching out to them. Reaching out to pull them in. Because no one is too far gone. No one is too far gone. Anybody can come. As he said the whole chapter, everyone who calls on the name of the Lord. He holds out his hands because no one is too far gone. God is holding hands out to them. Even though the people are intentional and they're persistent and they're contrary. Do you know anybody who almost everything that comes out of their mouth is just simply contrary? I mean, you can make any statement and they're going to counter what you say just because they like being opposite. You know, you could say the sky is blue and they're going to talk about how, no, it's not. It's actually this, 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 and this. Or you could say that carpet is green and they'll say, no, it's not. It's actually this, 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 and this. You know, and they'll just like to be argumentative. And that's what he's talking about, these people. They're contrary. They're argumentative. They want to be opposite. And he says, even to those people, he says, I'm holding out my hands to them because nobody's too far gone. It's the image of the prodigal son, right? The prodigal son in Luke chapter 15, who came to the father and asked for his inheritance long before the father died. Father gave it to him. Son went out, squandered the father's inheritance on terrible, terrible things, spent money on things that the father would be ashamed of, ran out of money, had to feed pigs, shameful to the Jew in that particular time, and finally decided he's going to go home to his father and beg for just a job as a servant in his father's house. And as he's, remember the story, as the son is coming back to his father's house, he's rehearsing in his mind what he's going to say to his father, just so he can try to get a job working for him. And when he comes over the hill to see his father's house, having been gone for some time, what is the position of his father? It's the position of God here in chapter 10, verse 21. The father sees his son. Because the way Jesus tells the parable, the father has been watching for his son every day, standing at his house on a hill, anticipating the possible day his son might come home. Even if he might not, he's ready to welcome him home. So that when the son comes and he sees his son, it says he runs to him, which again was shameful for a man to do in the first century of that day and time. And he embraces him and has a celebration for his son because he just wants him home. No matter what his son's been doing, no matter where he's been gone, the fact is of the matter in the moment, it wasn't about where the son's been. Son's home. And he's ready to welcome him home. Now, you know, as the story goes too, the other son in the house was upset that son came home. The other son only saw that son as a shame on the family, as a rebel who went out and did terrible, terrible things. While the father just saw that his son was home now. Far too often, I will say people in general, but Christians in general, we'll see somebody who has made poor decisions and label them as a poor decision maker with whatever phrasing. And every time they see that person, even if that person's turned their life around, that's all they see them as is the label. That kind of person who sees somebody like that, they're the older brother in the parable. They just complain and get frustrated and they're mad. When the reality is we need to be like God, like the father in the parable, embracing anybody who's willing to come, no matter where they come from, no matter what they've done, no matter where they are. There's another great story about, the story's from Billy Graham's funeral a number of years ago. It's probably, I don't even know how long, 10 years ago maybe now? Each of Billy Graham's kids got up at his funeral and told stories. Well, one of Billy Graham's kids, his daughter Ruth, had made some poor decisions. And she was dating this one guy, and her whole family was hesitant about this relationship. Thought this wasn't a good deal. She thought she knew better than everybody. So she quickly married this guy and discovered, she says within 24 hours, she knew this was bad. And he was turned abusive, and she ended up leaving him after a couple weeks. And that she was across country from where her parents were. Her parents lived on a mountain in, one of the Carolinas. And so she was going to drive from where she was with that abusive man to her parents. And she did what the prodigal son did. On that journey to her parents' house, all she's doing is anticipating the conversation because they had all told her not to do this. And so she's anticipating what they're going to say, what she's going to say, how she's going to get through this. And the way she tells the story at the funeral, you know, you never want to disappoint your father, never want to disappoint your mother. But when your father's Billy Graham, you really don't want to disappoint him. And she knows she's done that. She says, so she's, and that second day is she knows she's going to see them that day. She says, her heart starts racing. And she pulls onto the mountain. She gets close to their house and turns into the drive. Her heart's beating out of her chest. And she doesn't know how this is going to go, if she's about to get chewed out. She says, as she is pulling up to the house, her father's waiting. It's the image of Luke 15. He's waiting in the front yard. No telling how long Billy Graham's just been standing there. He's waiting in the front yard. She gets out of her car The only thing he says as he hugs her and is crying, he says, "Welcome home. I love you." That's all. There wasn't, "I told you so." There wasn't, "You never should have done that. You should listen to us." It was, "Welcome home. I love you." You see, no one is too far gone. If you're still here, if anybody is still here, they're not too far gone. God's infinite love is infinitely patient and gracious and merciful. And so anybody can come to Jesus. But you want to know something else? In Ephesians chapter 5. If that's who God is, he's infinitely gracious, he's infinitely merciful, he's infinitely loving and patient and forgiving. Paul tells us in Ephesians 5, he says, "Therefore, be imitators of God." So if God is all those things, and we are supposed to be, like he said back in Romans chapter 8, we're supposed to be coming more like Jesus every day, and he says outright in Ephesians 5:1, be imitators of God, then we are supposed to be infinitely patient and infinitely loving and infinitely gracious and merciful and forgiving. We're not supposed to have a cap on how much we forgive, on how much we love, on how much mercy and grace we offer. We're supposed to be infinite in how much we give because he is to us. Paul tells us also, you love because God loved you first. He loved you first. And he's infinitely patient with you. So we ought to be the same with everybody else. We ought to never give up on somebody coming to Jesus. No matter who they are, how far they've gone, how much they've done to you, how much they blast on social media. We ought to never give up on somebody coming to Jesus. And so we need to keep speaking Jesus to everybody. Keep speaking Jesus to everyone. And keep praying the gospel for everyone. Without fail, without falter, without hesitation, no matter where they are or what they're doing, or where they may find themselves in the middle of. They may be the prodigal son, and they're wallowing in the pigsty, and they're spending their money on terrible things that dishonor God, and they're living their lives that way. But that's not on us to call them out for that. It's on us to love them and show them and bring them to Jesus, speak Jesus and pray Jesus and show them the way back to Jesus. Show them the way back to Jesus. Bring them to Jesus. Keep speaking Jesus to everybody. Keep praying the gospel for everyone. And then the inevitable hard question is, how often do you speak about Jesus? How often do you speak about Jesus? You know, you speak about what you think about. So how often do you speak about Jesus? How often do you think about Jesus? If we're supposed to be speaking Jesus to everyone, demonstrating Jesus to everyone, how often do you speak about Jesus? How often do you think about Jesus? And for whom do you need to be praying today? Praying the gospel for everybody. Who is it who has wandered so far away they need to come back? And again, that's not the type of deal that, and this is none of your Sunday school classes do this. This is only other people. They'll say, we need to pray for so-and-so because they did this, 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 and this. But the intention behind saying that is to say how bad the person is and not necessarily the prayer. Again, that's not y'all. That's other people. Nobody in this church does that. It's everybody else. Trying to rip somebody else down in the process. You know, there are those who are genuine and sharing needs, but sometimes the truth of the situation is sometimes we all do that. We share negative news about somebody else. Not because our true intention is love and prayer, but because sharing negative news about somebody else makes us feel better about us. Can you believe so-and-so did that? So-and-so did this. I saw this. I saw them out doing such and such. I saw. Did you see on social media what they said on the thing? I went down in the comments 3 days past, and I saw the thing, and they said this, and it was, and then this guy said this, and oh, man, it was good. That's not honoring to Jesus. But if we're being genuine and honest, we can speak Jesus over that, speak Jesus into that, pray through that situation. We need to examine our own hearts because just as much as everybody else needs Jesus, I need Jesus. You need Jesus. We need to check ourselves in those moments. What is my true motivation in this? When you're having those imaginary conversations about how you're going to rip somebody to pieces later, and what you're really going to say when the moment arises, you need to shut that down, because that's the enemy bringing a strategy into your mind of how to dishonor God in a conversation rather than how to speak Jesus in a conversation. We need to speak Jesus to everyone. We need to pray the gospel for everyone. Who do you need to pray for? Maybe there's a name up here on the prayer pew you need to, that is already here that you put here. Or maybe you need to put a new name up here on the prayer pew that needs to be prayed over. And every day I'm here, I pray over all this on the prayer pew. And you need to put it up here. And it's somebody who is in desperate shape and they need Jesus. Maybe you need to put your own name. Say, I'm in desperate shape. Maybe just put your initials. Some people have done that, just put initials. This person needs Jesus. I need Jesus. Maybe you need to believe in Jesus today. Believe in Jesus. Believe that Jesus is God's son. He died so all your sins will be forgiven. Believe that Jesus rose from the dead so you can live after you die. Jared mentioned at the beginning, this week at VBS, we had four people come to know Christ. During VBS, one of them was one of the youth volunteers. Had been serving in VBS and got saved. Maybe that's where you're at today. You need to believe in Jesus today. In Jesus' death and resurrection. In Jesus buying your salvation. You just need to believe. Have faith, as Paul talks about. And see what God can do in you and through you today.